back, guys. Welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 199. We're almost there. Almost to the big 200. Today, Deborah, we had a little bit of a scheduling mix-up, so Deborah can't make this one, but we will be here with our guests soon. And yeah, we're really, really excited for this one. Should be good. Monica Perez and Courtney Turner. But other than that, let's get some business out of the way. Monica might hop on here a little early. And yeah, guys, we are a value for value production. I feel like the shows we've been putting out since we've been back, minus the one where the last hour of the show was an argument over stupid stuff, have been really good. And our good friend Mark sent us our first monetary donation since we've been back. So Mark sent a really good one. 3 digits on PayPal he sent us. And that was really, really generous. Mark, you are the executive producer for this episode, episode 199. So guys, yeah, if you're in the giving mood, go ahead and get in the show notes and find all the ways you can donate back to the show. Time, talent, treasure. Hey, Leroy. And yeah, if you can't do any of those, just give us a 5-star review or and a nice written review and recommend us to your friends and family who you think might gain some value from the show as well. But other than that, life out here on the farm is good. We had some really nice weather last week, and I think it is finally over. Got nothing but 50 degrees and rainy for the next few weeks, and then the temps will just slowly start dropping, and then we'll be in our typical 38 degrees and drizzling until May. But the farm's going well. It's operating nicely. It's nice to see that it's getting, the pig area is getting a little muddy. And I went out there today and I've got a little piglet. One of the ones we're raising for pork is not doing well. He's laying in the straw, not moving, not eating. And I don't think he's going to make it. So I talked on the phone to the guy that I got our original breeding pair from. He told me what he would do, which is just cull it. He says I like the way that they run their farm. They don't do any sort of vaccines or anything like that. And if one's not resistant to parasites or has like bad hooves or whatever, they cull it and don't reproduce with it, you know. And that's how they strengthen and make their herd hardier. And I kind of prefer to do it that way. So I took the little guy, I put him in the barn with a heat lamp and some dry hay. And Emily's going to go out there now, try to get him some fluids. And then we're just going to let him be. And if he starts coming back, we'll let him. But if he passes, that's just the way it goes. It's really hard to figure it out. So Emily's here. She just walked in the room. Do you have something to say?
Well, my mom was there. I was just going to say hi. I was going to tell her I was about to go give the piggy some molasses.
No, your mom's not on this week.
Okay, bye.
Okay, see ya. But other than that, yeah, everything else is going good. The sheep are doing well. And we got, oh, Courtney's here. We'll kind of wrap this up in a minute. But yeah, send prayers for our little piggy. And longtime listener, Adam and his wife Emily, not me and my wife Emily, had their first baby. And we just want to say congratulations to them and send some prayers their way. I think he's doing really good, little baby Aiden. So congratulations, man. We're really, really happy for you. And Oh yeah, guys, we have a Telegram chat. It's been dead for a long time. Barely anybody in there, barely anybody doing. Drew Misson goes on there and promotes his show. That's about it. If you guys want to get back in there, it's t.me/Deborah gets red pilled. I think the link to that is in the show notes as well. If we could get that going again, that'd be cool. I'm in a couple chats from different shows that are about probably our size, and they're going nonstop. So it'd be cool to get it in there. I'll try not to be such a an Ashkenazi in there anymore, and I won't kick people out as much for just speaking their mind. I just don't like it when people get into like big theological arguments in there. That's kind of something I'd like to get away from, but if we want to get in there with conspiracies and all sorts of stuff like that, now go for it. Let's just get it back up and going again. Homestead, conspiracy, also current events, geopolitics. Get in there and start chopping it up. Other than that, yeah. I think that's all the news. I mean, the world is wild right now. This stuff over there in that little country in the Middle East is, I think it's breaking the matrix. This is what's going on is wild. I think the only people that are supporting that place anymore are people that were fully indoctrinated in homes as kids or schools and things like that, who still have those beliefs. I think a lot of those people don't have those beliefs that they should support that country anymore. And boomers are the only ones that want us, want to wipe the little country off the face of the map. That's what they say. But it's just crazy to see what's going on. I mean, I got someone that you would never ever expect to do this, to question that big six number of what happened in the 40s in Germany and Poland. And yeah, they are a ethnically, I don't even know if it's ethnic. They are a someone who identifies as Jewish. It's crazy. So I think that's happening. I think people are starting to realize the lies that have been told, the corruption in all these groups like AIPAC, and what the ADL does and how horrific it is, and what they do just to perpetuate these lies that aren't benefiting anyone but them. So the matrix is broken. Yeah, it's just fractured. What if America going to war to support Israel was what finally brought everyone together against, not wanting to do that? And I think that something like that could be happening. But just keep your head on a swivel. We're going to get PSYOP upon PSYOP upon PSYOP. We are in the weapons of mass destruction, babies in incubators stage. Nothing that we can look at, especially in the mainstream media, is real. And that's all going to go one way to promote, one side. So, use your best discernment, I guess. That's the way to do it. All right, I'm going to pause, let the guests in, guys. Bye.
Hello.
All right, guys, we're back, and we are here today with two returning guests, Monica Perez and Courtney Turner. What's going on, guys?
Not too much.
Hey, been crazy.
I'm really happy to have you both here. Monica, you've been a longtime favorite of the show. I think maybe this is your third or fourth time back on. And did you just put out the Boston bombing
Yes.
episode we did a long time ago?
I just reposted. It was the most lost episode in my entire life. No one can ever find it. You can't search for it. Finally, you sent me the file and I put it on Deep Dives with Monica Perez, which is the best treatment I've ever given of the Boston Marathon bombing. It's just 1 hour of all the things that were not true about the official narrative and how I could prove it. And that was the moment that the scales fell from my eyes. So it's something people have asked me about. So if they want to hear that, I just finally got it back, so that it's accessible to the public. Weird, though, that it was so totally suppressed.
Yeah, I have this weird thing, like my whole catalog isn't available on iTunes anymore. I kind of got to figure out why. So, but Courtney, you were on a little while ago, and you're back, and we're really happy to have you here. I love the research you do into Tavistock, and I think that's kind of what we're going to get into today.
It's a monster.
Yeah, it's probably never ending. But Monica sent me a little bit of a an outline of what we should do. You guys want to just jump in?
Sure.
So can I just say that Courtney and I have done like 6 hours on this already, and it's on both of our feeds. So this, I thought, like the Boston Marathon bombing, we could do just a 1 hour highlights, and then if people really want to dig in, they can go to our feeds for that. And I'm gonna hang back, and no offense, Courtney, but you are a fire hose of information, and I'm gonna just stand back and try not to get blown away. But if you need me, I'll just do some research in real time or something.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, I like that.
Yeah.
Real time research works. I don't know. So do you want me to just turn on the fire hose?
Yeah, I've got I opened up the hydrant with the wrench. I got one of those wrenches, and you just need to open the nozzle.
All right. Awesome. Well, where I like to start is kind of the very beginning. So Tavistock is I call it like the mother shadow think tank, and it's really the father of like social science, psychology, and of course what we know today to be modern propaganda. And you may be familiar with Edward Bernays. He was a double nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he was the one who wrote the book Propaganda. I will just as a side note say that Willy Munzenberg, who was a PR expert in Germany, is also kind of a, I think he rightfully deserves a co-share in that title. But we'll focus on Bernays, and he used a lot of Freud's, talk therapy. I think he called it actually the talking cure. And that's today we know it as talk therapy. And that was the cornerstone of what Tavistock used for their method. And it was also what they used as the foundation for their research in propaganda, in creating propaganda and modern day PR, public relations. And it was, so they were kind of the forerunners of this Tavistock Institute. But since I was saying that I like to start at the beginning, I will start with Wilhelm Wundt. He was the known as like the grandfather of psychology. And he actually gave the first PhD ever. He himself had no formal degrees or training, but he created the PhD program, of which William James was one of his most notable students, who is known as the father of American psychology. And that history is very interesting. If people want to go further into it, I would look into the Leipzig connection. He had many students who were quite famous, Pavlov being one of them. I'm sure many people have heard of, Pavlovian experiments and research. And that was also a huge foundation for Tavistock and for their research. And he was related, Wilhelm Wundt, that is, he was related to, who was it? I'm trying to find his original name. But his code name was actually Raphael in the Illuminati. So let me see where I can find that. If people want to look up the actual documentation for that, I don't know where it is in my notes, but I'll find it. So he was the kind of father of psychology, and from there he had as I was mentioning, several students, and one of them being, let me see if I can just find this. Sorry, these are all over the place. Yes, here it is. So one of them being, right, his code name. Oh, okay, this is the name. This is why I can never remember. It's Kirschenrat, Karl Casimir Wundt, whose code name in the Illuminati was Raphael. And people want to look that up to verify that. It is in Illuminati Provincial Report from Utica, September 1782. And so several of his students were, as I mentioned, Pavlov, William James, and then Stanley G. Hall, who was a mentor to James Dewey. James Dewey was very instrumental in exporting the you know, what we think of modern day education program in the United States, which is based on the three-tier Prussian model. So the Cliff Notes version of that is essentially after the Battle of Jena during the Napoleonic Wars in 1807, they lost this battle, the Battle of Jena. They couldn't figure out why they lost this battle, and they realized that it was because these soldiers were rebellious and they needed to breed mindless, obedient soldiers. That is the translation of what they said, and hence was born this three-tier Prussian model of education, which was then exported to the United States. Because they felt that controlling the United States was largely important to executing their plans, which are akin to what we would now call the New World Order. It's gone through many different names. You know, of course, now they're saying things like Great Reset. There was, the Order for the New Ages. It's gone through many iterations, but essentially the goals are pretty similar. And I would argue they are very very similar to the goals of the Illuminati. And I will read those, the five main goals that they've outlined, Adam Bishop. Yes.
What were the three things of the education, or are you getting back to that?
Oh, the three tier of the Prussian model. So I don't have an outline of that specifically, but essentially they had a top tier, which they wanted to breed obedience amongst all classes. But the top tier was to groom aristocracy or the elite
Germany
class.
Still has that a little bit where you get sidetracked.
This is why we have the prep schools and the ivory towers, where of course not, you know, sometimes it's on merit, but a lot of times we see legacy and that sort of thing. Yes.
Was that war situation? I think I've heard the stories, like they got these guys out to war and then they realized that like normal people don't want to murder other people. And that was the issue they were having.
Yes.
Okay.
The morality kicked in and opposed to be a slight hindrance to their orders.
Yeah. Why Johnny can't shoot. I think. Yeah, I've seen that. I think McFarlane from the Libertarian Institute did a little 15-minute short on, like, it's been a problem since the Greeks. They miss on purpose and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, surprisingly, or maybe not so surprising, it is actually not so easy for a human to kill another human being and not have some sort of moral qualms about it, even That's in great. The case of war. So these are the five tenets of that Bishoft outlined for the Illuminati manifesto. And I'm just going to read these really briefly because I think it'll help make everything else kind of make sense. So the first one was the abolition of monarchies and all ordered government. The second one was abolition of private property and inheritances. And we see this, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. The third one was abolition of patriotism and nationalism. And the fourth one was abolition of family life and the institution of marriage and the establishment of communal education of children. And I will say this is very relevant to Tavistock because one of their first issues of order was to de-elevate women. It was an attack on women. This is kind of the origins of the modern day women's liberation movement, which of course has seen many waves and many iterations and has parlayed into what we now call the trans or Skittles type movement, which of course
Transformers. Is,
the Transformers. Yeah.
I'm blown away.
You are.
It was the de-elevation of women because like that's what's like now it's come full circle. So where it just drives me crazy that the winningest woman on Jeopardy is a guy. I'm like, so in order to like the very best women are guys or is it
Ken, did Ken Jennings just put on like a wig?
Well, it's I actually think that it was a little bit of a setup and that other guy there was another guy who should have taken that crown, but he was usurped by this transgender woman.
He should have taken the tiara.
Yes, he should.
Well, I think it's paving the way, of course, for the transhuman agenda. And of course, you just think of it mimetically. They typically don't say transgender, they say trans. And I think that's paving the way for transhuman, which they often also just say trans. So there's many parallels, but if you think of the occult origins of this as well, you know, of course the pagans worshipped a hermaphroditic demiurge. That was the ideal, this hybridized form of male-female. And I think that's where the transgender is really leading towards, this transhuman. And of course, a chimeric kind of a being. If you can, you know, change whatever form you're born in, then of course, you know, what's the difference if you, you know, merge with machine or, yeah.
What was number five?
Okay, was number five is the abolition of all religion. So, of course, they want to usher in the one world religion. And
ecumenism, Chrislam.
And this is why we have the infiltration of all these different religions. Of course, the infiltration of, you know, the churches and, you know, the collusion of mega churches. Yeah.
This is Weishaupt himself wrote this. Is in that book that I probably have from 1740 that says like proofs of a conspiracy. Where did you get that?
1798. So proofs of a conspiracy. John Robison has that.
Yeah.
In it, there is also a code of the Illuminati. So proofs of a conspiracy George Washington used to warn the Americans about the infiltration of the Illuminati and the Masons, and to warn America that was
interesting. The Masons were infiltrated. Okay. Yeah. So, but you just read these five things. To be clear, what's your source?
Oh, so this one is coming, but there are many though, because the proofs of a conspiracy outlines it. There's also Code of the Illuminati, which is actually the book. It was written the same year, 1798. And that was used by Thomas Jefferson to warn about the infiltration of the Illuminati. Then there is this, The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, which is by William Still. And then there is another book that actually outlines it as well. I don't have it in front of me, but it is by Josephine Emmanuel Mann with two N's. And he takes, so it is often said that the Communist Manifesto was actually plagiarized, that Marx plagiarized it. And he was kind of publicly called out for plagiarizing quite often. But with the Communist Manifesto, so what happened was the Illuminati was then officially, quote unquote, shut down in the late, I believe, 1700s. And then they went off underground. So they had many offshoots. So they had, one of the offshoots was the League of the Outlaws. Then from there, they had the League of the Just, which the translation would be League of Just Men. I typically kind of note them as being the, you know, early codification of what we would today call like the social justice warriors. And then this was League of Just Men, and it was helmed by Marx and Engels. And then from there, they had the Communist League, and Engels was at the head of the Communist League, and he was commissioned to write a manifesto for the Communist League. And what he did was he took Weishaupt's Illuminati manifesto, and then he also plagiarized from this book, which is Clinton Roosevelt, who is a cousin of Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, FDR. It's The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law. And so there was, so the Josephine Emmanuel Mann book takes this and the Illuminati Manifesto book, and he basically illustrates how it became the Communist Manifesto. So what a lot of people don't know is the Communist Manifesto actually didn't have Karl Marx's name on it initially. They did a whole PR kind of campaign for Karl Marx to promote him and elevate his public sphere and persona. And they had written this, they commissioned Engels to write this, and then they, a few years later, put Marx's name on it. So I remember when I first went down like the really far rabbit hole of Marxism, and I was like, this looks a lot like Satanism. Like, you just kind of can't, you know, study Marxism and not end up there. And then I found out that Marx was himself an avowed Satanist. He actually wrote odes to Satan himself.
Source, please.
Yeah. So I have two. There is one book is called Marx and Satan. And then the other one is called, where is it?
I feel like I'm being Deborah. Is that okay? I said I was going to sit there and do nothing, but I can't.
No. You're great.
Did you even believe that when I said I was like, I'm just not going to say anything?
No,
like,
I didn't. But
anyone listening just be like, are you kidding me? Like, you don't even know yourself yet?
It was I don't remember the title, and I don't see that well, so it's hard for me to pinpoint, but it's the author is Wurmbrandt. So
how do you spell that?
Wurmbrandt. Let me see.
Yeah, that's close enough. I just
okay. Brand.
Just wanted to make sure I was understanding those sounds correctly.
Yes. Yes,
it's funny because like when I do this to people, I ask them the source and stuff like that. Like people think I'm messing with them, but
yes,
with you,
I understand. So this is Mark Sensate.
Yeah,
and that is Richard Boom Brandt. And then I'll find the other one. It is Mark. I know I have it up there. I just can't find it.
Yeah.
It is. So with the other one was.
Because there's, I have a couple of books on Jack Parsons in Pasadena, mm-hmm. where like he was basically instrumental in founding JPL. They did it kind of out of Caltech and Pasadena City College. And he was absolutely a Satanist, like absolutely.
Yeah.
Aleister Crowley and stuff, like they all circled up that even L. Ron Hubbard was in the mix, I think.
Have you been watching that? Have you watched that show? I think it's on Hulu, Monica, yet about him?
No, Jack Parsons?
Yeah, there's like a whole series about like it's called Strange Angel.
Fantastic.
It's not a documentary. It's like a, you know.
But like a little dramatized thing.
Yeah, it's probably not.
Oh, I would love to.
Not accurate at all, but they show him getting into like Thelema and all this sex magic.
That's okay. For stuff like that isn't super powerful as a narrative, I don't mind if it's not true, but like Netflix has just been doing one after another of documentaries on stuff that I know about, everything from like Uncle Ted to the Boston Marathon bombing, and I just cannot watch them at all because they're so wrong. But if it's just Jack Parsons, like, you know,
yeah, some of them,
it's going to be interesting.
Some of them, they're serial killer
stuff.
The
second one is The Devil in Marks, and it's Paul Kanger.
What was that one?
So just The Devil in Marks, and it's Paul Kanger.
Kanger, got it.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay,
I knew
sorry,
that was, yeah, and I know I have it behind me. I just can't find it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Okay,
sorry.
I'm going to watch that. Sorry, Adam, I was
that's okay.
On you. I'm totally watching that. Okay.
So do we want me to continue or do you want to? Okay. So, all right. So now we haven't even gotten to, but it's kind of a good little background because, you know, people need to know where these ideas stem from and who some of the players are that are pushing this forward. And of course, how this came to the United States. So then we have in 1909, the Secret Intelligence Service, which was a MI6 British intelligence, and Freud Jung visit William James, who we just learned was one of the disciples of Wilhelm Wundt and the founder, you know, the father of American psychology. I was talking about, and he was also the mentor, Stanley G. Hall, we were talking about, but James was also instrumental in exporting the, you know, modern day education system to the United States that's based on the three-tier oppression model. And Stanley G. Hall was a mentor who was also to John Dewey, who was also very instrumental in this exploitation of the education system. And he was this disciple of Wilhelm Wundt. And he was also the co-author of the Humanist Manifesto later in 1933. Humanist Manifesto is one of the journals of the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. Just prior to it becoming the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations at the time, it was known as, kind of went by a couple of names. It had the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology and the Tavistock Clinic. So it's got lots and lots of different names throughout the years, and also sometimes simultaneously, you know, like all of these little shadowy secret societies and entities, they tend to work like webs. They use what Adam Weishaupt actually called the rings on ring structure. And he called it that because it was modeled after the Jesuits. He was a student of the Jesuits. He was a professor at Ingolstadt. And he recognized that, you know, part of the reason why they were so effective was because they had this hierarchical structure, and because they needed to give people a sense of clout and incentivize them in order to want to advance in their systems. And this is part of why they use secrecy. That was so important. Yes.
I just want to get on the roster for you bringing the whole Jesuit thing to me. Like, as a practicing Catholic, I was like raised to think the Jesuits were not even Catholic. So yeah, not even Catholic. So
militaristic arm. I mean,
yeah,
that would be.
I know
like
nothing
saying
about the Vatican. Like, I should go down that rabbit hole because then I could just like say whatever I want because I'm in that, you know.
Yeah.
group. Well, I mean, it's so like, I should be an expert on bad stuff about the Vatican.
Well, yeah,
you can give it to me.
You and Leo Zagami can powwow. Because he was a Vatican insider. He was also an Illuminati insider. He was a third degree Mason. Yeah, and he writes these tomes. They're like always 700 to 900 pages long. And he calls them confessions because they are. He was also a music producer. So he's revealing, you know, his own personal experience combined with his research. And he's a phenomenal investigative researcher. But he also has personal experience as someone who has grown up in this world and milieu and was very much immersed in it. You know, so, yeah. But yeah, it's the same thing with like, you know, I always feel like I have to preface by saying, like, this does not mean Catholics are bad any more than the fact that, you know, Mossad may do things we don't like. That does not mean all Jews are bad. The Khazarians may have done a lot of things we don't like. That does not mean Jews are bad. You know, the list goes on and on. But, you know, it's like we may not like what Hamas is doing. This doesn't mean that Muslims are bad. You know, people are people. There's good and bad in everyone. And I think that that's the biggest lie of them all, which Tavistock was so instrumental in doing. They actually called it segmenting. This is part of where, you know, the identity politics was born out of. Tavistock oversaw and advised a lot of members of both the Frankfurt School and, of course, the Fabian Socialist. And the Frankfurt School was very instrumental in creating this identity politics because they recognized that if you strip people of their individual identity and you put them into groups where you slap the label on the group, people are much more likely to fight against each other, and you weaponize compassion because now they become compassionate mama bears who want to defend their group. And they would be much less likely to be that antagonistic if they were looking another human being one-on-one in the eye. So, yeah. But yeah, I feel like that's the biggest lie of them all. And we need not to fall into their traps.
Because there's definitely stuff on the internet that I've seen. I forget the guy's name, where he talks about how like the problem with, I don't know if it's Christians or Americans or whatever, is that they're individualistic and what they need is like group evolutionary behavior. I forget what it is, but it's interesting that in itself, which sounds like, it kind of reminds me of when like the conservatives say, well, of course, you know, Russia and China are going to beat us because they have like total control. We need a little of that. I'm like, that's the opposite of what we need. But okay. Anyways, that's
the opposite. Yeah. And this is really what Tavistock was all about. They were all about, they had a group research dynamics institute. They had all of these group research organizations, and they were all subsets of Tavistock. We'll get to that, but that's like Wilfred Bion. And of course, Wilfred Bion's work very much influenced Kenneth Rice, and Kenneth Rice then teamed up with Rioch. Later, it was in the 30s, and exported that. Actually, I think it was even later than that. I'll have to find the date. But they exported the Rice Institute in the United States, and that became kind of like an arm of Tavistock, but here in the United States.
Is that where Rice University came from?
I have to look that up because I have now been asked that a few times, and I do not want to give misinformation, but I suspect it does. I've gone down the Hillsdale rabbit hole, but I haven't gone down the Rice University rabbit hole. So, yeah, Hillsdale actually has like a, they have a Masonic Lodge, number 33 is their Masonic Lodge. They, you know, they, Hillsdale was founded on this premise. One of their big PR campaigns was that they do not take government funding. That is actually not at all true, neither locally nor, you know, their main institution. Whitmer endorsed them. They are now doing these charter schools, which is why I started going down this. I mean, I had other reasons, I just suspect, but now that they're really trying to implement these charter schools locally, of course, a lot of people who are overwhelmed by the idea of homeschooling are very excited at the prospect of sending their kids to a Hillsdale charter school. And I just caution them because they are getting funding from the government, and therefore there are strings attached to that. So, yeah.
This says Rice University is a private, non-affiliated coeducational institution of higher learning located in Houston. In 1891, with an endowment of $200,000 payable after his death, William Marsh Rice created Rice Institute for the advancement of literature, science, and art. Unfortunately, the birth of Rice Institute was fraught with problems, including fraud, murder, and an extended probate, et cetera, et cetera. But it does appear that it is
separate
related. No, that it's, yeah. But it had the same origin. So I'm going to put a link to that in the chat, okay, if Adam wants to put in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah. I'll start diving down that one because, yeah, that's come up a few times. So then where are we? Then 1885, we had the American Society for Psychical Research, which was founded. And William James was one of the founding members. And, of course, Freud and Jung were honorary members. And, okay, then where do we go from there? Then around, it's like around 1912 is kind of where the Wellington House began and had its early, start. And it was known as the British Propaganda Bureau. They did this under the guise that they needed a propaganda bureau in defense because Germany had a propaganda bureau. So this is a very common theme that we see under the guise of defense. They do these covert research operations. And unfortunately, oftentimes, in hindsight, we recognize that those operations then get weaponized against their own people, which is really what we saw with the Wellington House. It was also known as the Lie Factory. They actually called it this, the Lie Factory. I did a speech last weekend and I used like a little, what's it called, a graphic. And you can see like that's what they called the Wellington House, was the Lie Factory. So, of course, really instrumental were people like Edward Bernays was, a very prominent figure at the Wellington House. It was headed by... Charles Masterman was appointed to run the Wellington House. And the first thing he did was invite 25 authors, very prominent literary figures, people like H.G. Wells, people like Rudyard Kipling, who is a great devastation for me to learn because If is one of my all-time favorite poems. And it still is, I still appreciate it. But I was kind of sad to find out that he was a Wellington House asset. And then who else, like Chesterton, there were 25 of them, very prominent literary figures, and they were brought to write pamphlets and books to sway popular opinion in favor of war. And the purpose of this was to engage both the Britain populace as well as the Americans in the First World War on the side of the British. And this, they published over 1,600 pamphlets during the war. And they kept this going until 1936, and it was kept secret until that time. And so that was, and of course, this isn't new. Like we've, throughout history, we've seen the Romans, the ancient Greeks, and they used whatever means of pop culture. In the early days, it was like, that we know the Romans, the bread and circuses. There was the, sports and theater were used to create culture and to inculcate messaging. And of course, it just, what changed really was technology. So now in the beginning days of the Wellington House, the printing press was, very accessible. And so they were able to widely disseminate these pamphlets and books. And then of course, we'll see later, Tavistock is very invested in using radio for to sway public opinion, and then television. And then, of course, we go from there. Today's founder of today's modern propaganda machine, I would argue, is the nephew of Edward Bernays, and it is Mark Randolph Bernays. And so we then have film, and then, of course, now we have our little smartphones and all the social media.
That guy's running Netflix, right?
Huh?
That guy's running, his nephew's running Netflix? Is that?
Yeah, he's the founder. Yeah.
Okay.
Edward Bernays is a nephew, is the founder for, today's, I would argue it's today's modern propaganda machine.
Yeah.
So where are we now? Then we have, so they really wanted to get the Americans involved in the war, and of course on the side of the British. And so this was not, popular opinion at all. Americans really wanted to kind of mind their own business.
We're at World War One.
Yeah, this is okay. For World War One. Yep. And so what they did was they headed up something called the Creole Commission, and they appointed Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann, who's a journalist, to head this Creole Commission. And the job of the Creole Commission was to advise Wilson, which was also a very tall order, because Wilson actually ran on the campaign that he would not engage us in the First World War. And of course, he did exactly the opposite, and he became the first president known to use the term New World Order. So he was very much advised by Tavistock and their acolytes, and the Creole Commission was really instrumental in the swaying of public opinion in favor of engaging in World War One on the side of the British. And they weaponized the term isolationist. And I always reference this because, you know, of course, now we see the weaponization of the term conspiracy theorist. That was done in document 1035-960, countering the Warren Commission. So it was to avert any investigation into JFK's assassination. And back then, it was to, of course, tarnish anybody who wanted to just mind their own business and not engage in foreign entanglements, such as the First World War. And they resurfaced this, you know, weaponization of this word. I remember when Ron Paul was running and he was garnering a lot of support from the political right, who might have traditionally voted Republican. And of course, they could not have this. And so they kept demonizing him as this Looney Tune who had just crazy foreign policy ideas. And they kept saying, he's an isolationist, and we can't have that. And so they resurfaced this this term that really did come out of Tavistock as a way of trying to sway people to get into the First World War.
Did they have any influence, like in the like the Hun propaganda and the babies on bayonets and all that stuff?
That was, when was that? I feel like that was later.
I think that was for World War One, but it might have been for the to get the English riled up.
It sounds like something we would do. I don't know. I haven't come across it. Yeah. I know they did do, and this I think was during World War II, they did like experiments with bombing of civilians just to test their reaction and see what the trauma-based mind control induction would be. Yeah, that was like horrifying to me.
Real bombs, like really killing people with bombs and really to see what the fallout would be.
Yes.
Can I just tell you about that picture?
Yes.
It says, in 1914, during World War One, the German army passed through neutral Belgium to attack France. Afterward, many U.S. newspapers and magazines featured pro-war cartoons depicting alleged German atrocities in Belgium, particularly the killing of innocent women and children. This cartoon, which Adam was referring to, appeared in a 1915 edition of the weekly humor magazine Life. The slaughter in Belgium did not actually occur, but by 1915, tens of thousands of Africans had died in the Belgian Congo, victims of Belgium's ruthless, etc. It doesn't matter. But yeah, it was in Life magazine in 1915.
Life, which is definitely...
So it was in America against the Germans regarding Belgium, which didn't even...
Wow.
Got it.
Yeah, I don't know if they were behind that, but I can see that they would be. It wouldn't surprise me if they were, but I don't know. All right, so where are we now? So that's around, like, so that's from up until around 1920-ish is when the Wellington House was in operation. And then it became the Tavistock Clinic. And this was a donation from the 11th Duke of Bedford. It was in the Tavistock Square, but he was he donates this building, and it was specifically specifically designated to do shell shock therapy research on soldiers. So much like what we would call today post-traumatic stress disorder. But they were doing some pretty horrific things. And this Marquis of Tavistock, his name was Herman Arthur Russell, and he was related to William Huntington Russell, who, along with Alfonso Taft, who was the relative of President Taft, co-founded the Order of Skull and Bones in 1832. So Tavistock Clinic was given a direct donation from the relative of the founder of Skull and Bones. I just think, you know, of course, that doesn't directly implicate them, but it does seem like a lot of the worldviews are in alignment with some of these characters. So he was also himself the Order of St. John, the Knight of Grace, Order of Garter, Order of British Empire, and a Fellow of the Royal Society. At the same time, so around this like 1919, 1920 to 1921, Bowlby and Sargent were also conducting similar types of research, like insulin shock therapy research. And they were doing it at Moseley Hospital under Mapother, which was the Institute of Psychiatry. And they were doing very similar types of research. Bowlby was friends with Julian Huxley. So we might be familiar with him, the brother of Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World. He was also a founding member of UNESCO. He coined the term transhumanism. He was a eugenicist. He was a member of the League of Nations, the UN, and affiliated with the Cecils, and he later wrote the bio of Darwin. So there's Thomas Henry Huxley. So T.H. Huxley was known as Darwin's bulldog, and he was a teacher to H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells then was a teacher to the Huxley brothers. So you can see where this line of thought gets kind of carried throughout their mentors. I think that's really important for people, just as like a note for doing research, is to look at, you know, who the relationships are and who the mentors are. You get a lot of clues as to the levers of power and to the line of thought.
Yeah, if you want like a really good some really good evidence of what Huxley thought and what was going on and what's happening now, Jay Dyer broke down this like 1965 like speech that he gave at UC Berkeley to the student body, and he just lays everything out that's happening now. It's really, really good. My dad was, I don't know if my dad was at the speech, but he was at UC Berkeley when that happened.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
I'll have to check that out. I don't know if I've seen that one.
Yeah
he does great work. Yeah, so 1920, the Tavistock, it was also, as I was saying before, like it also went by the TIMP, which is Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology, which was part of why they brought on people like Wilfred Mayen. They were really trying to give it credibility as a hard science and not just the social sciences. And we'll see this later when they merge into the realm of psychiatry versus psychology. John Rawlings Reese was brought in as a deputy director of Tavistock. He actually became the director in 1932. He later became one of the founders of the World Federation for Mental Health. So he was, you know, like World Federation of Mental Health is one of these like, you know, globalist NGO organizations. And Reese was a fascinating character because he developed the Tavistock method. He was also very instrumental in part of the reason why Tavistock is such a shadow entity. And really, most people had never even heard of them until that whole transgender lawsuit came out 2 years ago or 3 years ago now. And it's partly because of Reese. Reese actually said he wanted them to be fifth columnists. So I'll just share a couple of quotes from Reese because I think it says a lot about their line of thinking and the purpose of Tavistock. Now, he wanted to, the Tavistock method was to induce control stress via what he calls psychologically controlled environments in order to make people give up their, you know, firmly entrenched beliefs when they're under peer pressure. So this is why they were so heavily invested in group dynamics, group research. It really was about stripping the individual. They were constantly studying, and not just Reese, but a lot of these Tavistock psychologists were constantly studying individual psychology versus group dynamics and how it was that they could alter individual, thought processes by immersing them in group dynamics. And let's see, he said that, it was based on psychoanalyst Wilfred Bion, and Kenneth Rice was also very influential in, as I had mentioned that before, about the group dynamics. And Rice was the one who created the Tavistock Center for Applied Social Research. And there were many of these like institutes for social research that cropped up. Of course, there was the one at Columbia University right after the Frankfurt School. had emerged, and then they immigrated to the United States and cropped up at Columbia University. There was, of course, the Michigan Institute for Social Research, though they had many centers where they were doing this all over the United States. And let me see if I can find some of these quotes from him, because they were crazy. He spoke of the necessity to disarm the mind. He said the aim should be to not only control nature, but human nature. He then later at a National Council for Mental Hygiene, which was also very closely affiliated with Tavistock, and he gave a speech on strategic planning for mental health. And he says that, this, and this is great, we can therefore justifiably stress the particular point of view with regard to the proper development of the human psyche, even though our knowledge may be incomplete. So even though they have limited knowledge, they feel completely justified, and they must aim to make it permeate every educational activity in our national life. I feel these quotes are just so shocking. How do we do
this? They don't know what they're doing, but they want to make sure that they influence everything everywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. And then he says, how do we do this? We infiltrate the most pervasive institutions, social culture. The education system, the church, public life and politics and industry shall all be within our sphere of influence. They want to control everything. And then they say, if we were to infiltrate the professional and social activities of other people, I think we must imitate, and this is really just shocking that he actually says this, totalitarians and organize some sort of fifth column activity. If better ideas on mental health are to progress and spread, then we as the salesmen must lose our identity. Let us all, therefore, be very secretly fifth columnists. And this was in the Mental Health Journal in October of 1940 that he says this. And just for people who don't know what fifth column, this is the actual definition of fifth column. It is a group of people who act traitorously and subversively out of secret sympathy with an enemy of their country. Yeah, and he's saying that they, salesmen for the social science and psychology, should be fifth columnists.
Can you reread that definition one more time?
Yes. So, a group of people who act traitorously and subversively out of a secret sympathy with an enemy of their country.
Wow.
I know. And he's like, this is a great thing. This is what we should do.
That's the show title right now. So the fifth columnist.
Yeah.
And their goal was to change human nature.
Yes.
By infiltrating all the institutions that influence
culture. And doesn't this sound exactly like what you hear people like Fink say? Larry Fink talks about how they're going to change social behavior. He talks about this. Of course, we have
Harari.
The World Economic Forum. You've all known Harari, Klaus Schwab. Yeah.
I think this is their Achilles heel, because I'm not sure you can change new human nature.
Oh, I don't think so. Unless you make it robotic.
Oh, unless
right?
You alter them.
Yeah, that remains to be seen. But of course, it's a feedback loop, and we don't know, because as of right now, AI can only go so far as humans program it. So the question becomes, that whether or not they're arguing that the AI can become sentient and then supersede organic life. But
you wouldn't even know if it was sentient. It can. At a certain level of advancement, we would not be able to tell whether it was sentient or just self-programming. Like, you know what I mean?
I
think
would.
It could mimic sentience.
I don't think so, because there's just things that humans do that are not rational. Like a lot of humor is not necessarily rational.
But I think, isn't like chaos theory or quantum physics, like, isn't that proof of free will? Like, at a certain point, you can't predict the future. So if there were something random, on a very fundamental level. I'm just saying they could seem exactly the same as this unpredictable human behavior without actually being self-aware, but they could say stuff that makes it sound self-aware. That's just
that
my
makes
theory.
It
but
difficult it's, to discern.
You wouldn't think, know, like it right. could be so sophisticated, so complex that, I mean, because you can't even define consciousness. So how could you teach it or know it was, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I still think that we would have a sense if they were to.
Oh, okay, do you think it's possible?
I don't think it is.
Have
I actually don't.
Yeah, I don't think so.
And I also don't think that randomness necessarily proves sentience. Of course, it makes it harder to decipher.
No. Yeah, I'm saying that because of quantum stuff, whatever, people will say there's no free will because right. you can predict a person's outcome based on their like life and the way their brains work. And that's sure. why Einstein didn't believe in quantum because he was a fatalist. He didn't believe in free will. So he said quantum stuff can't be true because that would imply like a fundamental unpredictability, which could mm-hmm. give rise to the possibility that human beings have free will, which he was not willing to countenance. And all I'm saying is if you had an AI that like on a very basic level, you had an element of chaos in, mm-hmm. you know, where one
sure.
like electrical impulse would go over another on a transistor small enough so that it wouldn't, you know, either path could be viable, but it would be unpredictable which path it would take. That would right. look exactly like free will, but it wouldn't actually be sentient.
It'd be free will,
randomness.
Yeah, no, I think that's not very possible.
I don't think we'll ever know if they're sentient or not. But I don't think you can have. I don't think you can create consciousness. I don't. I think
I don't
that's
think
like
so
your proof of God. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm gonna start worrying about it when they can make human hands that don't have six fingers. So that's my whole idea on the thing.
They don't.
Is that where they're stuck?
Yeah, they can't do hands.
Yeah, wow. No, yeah, I know. I did see that. That was very interesting.
Yeah,
some
of your high school portraits that fooled everybody, Courtney, had six fingers.
I know. It's so weird.
Maybe they'll all be Amish. Maybe all robots will have to be Amish. Don't a lot of Amish have six fingers?
I don't know. I know there's a place in Montana where there's a bunch of cats with six fingers or something.
I believe an early in the Pennsylvania, I could be, I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm trying not to offend people, but I do believe that there was an ancestor in one of those Amish communities who had six fingers and every once in a while.
The recessive gene.
They just tie it off with like a string.
That's how they get 20% more work done.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, leave it on there because my guess is it's.
It's not because they don't use technology and they're not distracted by all of the social media nonsense.
And they're evolving faster.
It's because they have six fingers. Okay.
Yeah. If the sixth one were a second thumb, that would probably.
That's how they get those. That's how they're able to raise those barns.
There you go. That's hilarious. All right. So where are we? 1933. So in 1920 is when they developed the Tavistock Clinic. It was also the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology. So where do we go from here? I'm trying to think. So 1933 is when Kurt Lewin, who was another director of the Tavistock Institute. It's like there's so many different players in this whole thing. Like there's a lot of names that I feel like would be just household names. You know, there's Eric Trist. And Eric Trist, even for people who are not familiar with the psychological or academic work of Eric Trist, they're probably familiar with his son, Alan Trist, who was the producer for The Grateful Dead. And of course, this is where we get these famous LSD experiments. And they use The Grateful Dead to conduct all of these sociological and, I guess, you know, drug experiments, really, just on the culture and on mind control. They were really trying to see what the results would be for mind control. They found that it wasn't that useful for mind control, is what they say. I'm not 100% convinced that that was really their discovery. But yeah, a lot of those studies, of course, you know, then a lot of the studies actually, I think in general from Tavistock, really parlayed into MKUltra. I think they were the foundation for MKUltra. Definitely the trauma-based mind control studies that we saw from the shell shock therapy, the insulin shock therapy research that was done, I think were, you know, huge and instrumental. The Himmler, Hitler experiments, those were out of Tavistock. So a lot of these experiments that people would think, you know, are pretty well known.
What? Tavistock worked with Hitler?
The Himmler experiments. Wasn't it Himmler, Hitler?
All right, Himmler, whatever. Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, wasn't Himmler working for Hitler?
So. Well, actually, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of, like,
just crossover on that eugenics stuff, yeah, like in the 30s. Yeah, in the 30s. Okay. There was I think America was like the nursery, the incubator of eugenics.
America?
I think eugenics started it here in the 30s or whatever. I feel like we were ahead of the Nazis and the eugenics, so it wouldn't surprise me that they worked together, but I'm surprised that they worked together. Like,
they definitely
it seemed like there was parallel, but I didn't realize it was actually interactive.
Oh, no, it was actually interactive. So, like, for the social scientists were the ones who created the IQ testing. The IQ testing was actually created for eugenics purpose. So Mensa, even on their website, had a whole section for eugenics. So yeah, they were definitely, Jung was very instrumental in the OS. He was a double agent of Tavistock, right? He was a double agent, though, of the OS and the OSS and the SF. So he worked for both, and his number was 488. Like, he actually, that was his actual number, and he was a double agent. And of course, he was, you know, very instrumental in Tavistock. So, yeah, I would say that, you know, the eugenics movement, Tavistock was very instrumental, and they were, of course, working with the eugenicists. I don't see them as being, like, just American. I see them as being this, you know, like, umbrella entity that we're still seeing today. We know that the Planned Parenthood was Margaret Sanger. She was working with Bill Gates's father. And that was a eugenics movement. The British actually empowered Hitler, his rise to power, and a lot of it was out of this eugenics movement. And people think that it was all about the Jews, but really it was about creating the Volk. And this is where we get the word folks. So if you look at a lot of the politicians, like Biden's always saying in his speeches, folks, you listen, folks, you know, and that word comes from the German Volk, which had to do with it was a eugenics term. It was all about propagating this very specific look and, type. So they wanted to propagate very specific genetics, and they had what was two camps of eugenics, which was like, one was called positive eugenics, one was negative eugenics. So the idea behind positive eugenics was that only people of certain lineage and genetics should breed and procreate. And then negative genetics, eugenics was, of course, about eradicating members of society. You know, we now call them the useless eaters is the term that a lot of people throw around. But essentially I think a lot of people misinterpret this about the Holocaust. It wasn't just about the Jews. Of course, a lot of Jews were sacrificed, but it was Jews. It was disabled. It was the Blacks, Gypsies, really just anybody who was
Catholics,
not aligned with the Volk.
Down syndrome. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it was really all about the Volk. That's what they were really trying to propagate, because they, as much as they were nationalists, they wanted it to be a German, right? Aryan race is what they wanted to take over. So in my opinion, it's no different than the British imperialism. It was just a different flavor. But what we don't know,
if we're talking about that, Courtney, can I ask, is there a link to, I'm sure there is, I'm just asking because I want to know, a link to the Bolshevik Revolution and the Holodomor?
Yeah, so is there a link on which front? So there is definitely...
were they involved with the Bolsheviks? And I mean, because there was a massive genocide there as well.
Sure. So the Bolshevik Revolution, there was definitely a connection with, so a lot of the Frankfurt School members were also members of Tavistock. Of course, a lot of the founding members were Fabian socialists, so this is kind of a convergence of the two. But the Frankfurt School was born out of a meeting that was had by Lenin called this meeting right after the Bolshevik Revolution when it didn't. I'm sure there's a, you know, earlier connections as well, but I'll share this because I know this for sure. He was very concerned that it didn't spread throughout the West because Karl Marx has said that it would. And so that he didn't understand why that didn't happen. So he had a meeting in 1922 between Antonio Gramsci, and this can be found in Antonio Gramsci's grandson's memoirs. So it was Antonio Gramsci, Georgi Lukács, and Willy Munzenberg, who was one of the fathers of PR propaganda. And he had this meeting, and it was Antonio Gramsci who said that the problem was that they were looking at this as being an economic problem, and they were trying to spawn economic revolutions, and it really needed to be a cultural infiltration. And so it was from there that the Frankfurt School had started in Frankfurt, Germany, and then it launched in the, of course, they knew they had to take down the West. And so they came to the United States, they set up shop at Columbia University, they started what was called the Institute for Social Research. And then a lot of these Institute for Social Research cropped up elsewhere. But those were members of the Frankfurt School, and it was after the Bolshevik Revolution because—
And when they came to America, when it exported here, that's kind of the formation of the neocons, correct?
Yes. There's a really great movie about that. It's called Arguing the World. And I think it was 1998. And it is about the New York intellectuals. And of course, you know, players like Irving Kristol and
Krauss, the Straussians.
Yeah, there was a, I'm trying to think who all the players were. I remember Kristol, obviously, but yeah, so they, but that's a great movie about how, you know, the split, the schism between these New York intellectuals and the conservatism and the communists. And then, of course, you know, the neocons were born out of it. I honestly think NASA in many ways, which was born out of Operation Paperclip, was really in many ways, I think part of the messaging, the propaganda for NASA was to create neoconservatism. Because if you look at a lot of the neocons, the whole message around the moon landing, it's really kind of the thing that a lot of people can't separate. And it was done because we were in this race with the Soviets. And, you know, they, according to their own narrative, they were way ahead of us. And of course, we had to beat them. This is what makes American exceptionalism. And you hear this all the time. Well, we landed on the moon. And I actually think that it was very instrumental in crafting that narrative. And of course, the neocons are also, you know, the war hawks traditionally. And this is, I think, born out of this, you know, you could call it like the Five Eye type of, you know, intelligence apparatus. But part of that is Tavistock because they're doing the wartime research arm of it. So many of the different think tanks that work with Tavistock are like the Rand Institute and the Stanford Research Institute are kind of like the babies of Tavistock. And they work very closely together, mostly doing wartime research. Of course, you know, Rand here. Actually, their address, it's kind of crazy, is 1776 Main Street, Santa Monica. I don't think that was a coincidence. I don't know. That's just so odd to me. yeah, interestingly enough, the official formulation of the Illuminati was also, it was May 1st, 1776. So I don't think that was a coincidence either, but I could be wrong. Yeah, so they do all this wartime research, and I think they were very instrumental in creating this propaganda because what they do, you know, as the fifth generation warfare guide, they talk about, they're on their second one now, but this is their first one. But one of the main things they talk about is the best way to control the opposition is, of course, to lead it. And this is where we get these notions of things like controlled opposition. And Tavistock was creating a lot of these controlled opposition think tanks. So Dr. John Coleman lays out a bunch of them that are here in the United States, like the thing that we think of as being conservative, but when you take a closer look, they're actually neoconservatives. And I think that the whole neocon philosophy was really born to be a controlled op. That is my personal analysis. I can't necessarily prove that, but I really do think that that was a huge part of it. But it's, you know, organizations we'd be very familiar with, like Brookings Institute. Of course, Brookings does all the polling. And Tavistock, Bernays actually called it manufacturing a public opinion or manufacturing consent. You know, he went under both terms. That's what polling was. And they were much more transparent back then about, like, they called, you know, we now have a sense, one second, then we now have what, you know, a lot of these very woke corporations will do what's called sensitivity training. Well, under Tavistock, the National Laboratory, National Training Laboratories, which is a subset of Tavistock, it was actually called brainwashing. So, like, that's what they actually called it. So, yeah, this sensitivity training that we see, which seems a lot like brainwashing, that's what they actually did call it back then. But I'm sorry, what were you gonna?
I was just gonna say, Irving Kristol wrote a book which I reviewed, like, very comprehensively, called Neoconservatism: The Autobiography of an Idea. And he introduces it by saying, like, I was a neo-Marxist, I was a neo-Trotskyite, now I'm a neo-conservative. And it's like, there was no progression there except for that's a weird leap. And then he talks about how he needed to corral conservatives into being activist warmongers, actually. And that, but when it comes to economics and war, people need their opinions shaped and cannot be trusted to just vote, that the whole process of democracy is about getting people on your side and not hearing what they're saying. And that he had to change the conservative viewpoint from reacting to their constituents to guiding their constituents. That's in the intro.
Wow. Well, there you have it. And I mean, that was the primary agenda of the Tavistock Institute all the way from the beginning, from the Wellington House. It was always about manufacturing a public opinion in favor of war, and particularly, you know, in favor of, you know, engaging on the side of the British. And that's really aligned with what we're seeing today. It's aligned with what we saw in the Milner-Fabian conspiracy book, and how, you know, the British imperialists were really behind this, you know, movement to stoke the tensions to what we're now seeing looks like the beginnings of World War III. And my theory is that it's this corporation and it's a consortium. So you have the three city states. You have the Vatican is a city state. You have the City of London. And then you have Washington, D.C. And of course, they're owned by the Royal Crown. And so it looks, and they're it's corporations. And when you look at our U.S. Tax Revenue Code, it actually really says this about D.C. You know, it refers to it as a state, and it says you have to use these definitions. And then when you go and look at the definition of the state, it says D.C., Washington, D.C. So, you know, they play, basically apply all of these tax codes to people in D.C. They make some exceptions for territories like Puerto Rico, you know, other territories, and they make exceptions for certain industries. So, like, petroleum industry will be subject to tax code. But it's just, it's amazing that it's really just clear as day. They say this is a corporation. And that when they say, you know, Washington, D.C., that is the corporation of the United States. So a lot of people thought, I know this was circulating in 2020, and a lot of people kind of debunked it as a crazy conspiracy theory. But there was actually an organic act of 1871, which did incorporate the United States. And it was, you know, of course, in the city state of D.C. So it is a corporation. That does not mean that everything outside of it is a corporation. But, you know, there's definitely constituents outside of that. But there is an actual corporation. And that's very much how they operate. They operate like they're running, you know, a corporation and we're the serfs or employees or, you know, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, so some of these other, I'll just go through, because this is in Dr. John Coleman's Committee of 300 book. And I don't know why I can't hold this straight, but yeah. And he goes through some of these Tavistock institutions in the United States: Brookings Institute, the Hudson Institute, the National Training Laboratories, which works very closely with the NEA. So, you know, Education Institute, yeah. I think that's what it is, the National Education Association, Wharton Institute for Social Research, of course, it was Dorwin Cartwright and Ronald Lippert. But Cartwright had this saying that I thought was also just really kind of shocking. He says it's inconceivable that one persuasive person, through the use of mass media, could bend the world's population to his will. So essentially, like, you know, one person could manipulate. And I mean, that's what we're seeing. That's totally what the media does. You get these cult of personalities and they create a, you know, complete overhaul of public opinion. And we saw that through COVID. We saw that, right?
That's what annoyed me about Trump. I feel like Trump hijacked that Ron Paul energy.
Yes.
And just transformed it into like a personality thing.
Yep.
So Ron Paul used to read the Bill of Rights and Trump is just like, you know, I hate Maxine Waters, you know, and it was just the same energy and it was totally emptied of all content, but it was personality. It's like what Brzezinski said, like we want, you know, whatever what Brzezinski said about you want a charismatic leader.
Yes.
There was that quote from like the Technotronic era or something, like there'll be a charismatic leader and then whatever. It was very predictive, that book as well.
It was. Yeah. Okay. The Institute for the Future, Institute for Policy Studies. That's a really big one. What were some of the other ones? Stanford Research Institute, of course, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Wharton, RAND. RAND and SRI, I think, are kind of like the, you know, the first children, if you will. But yeah, it's the things like the Hudson Institute, there are a lot of them that are specifically designed to be, like, at least according to Coleman, the controlled opposition think tanks, because we think they're conservative think tanks and they're, in fact, working in opposition to what would be traditional conservative values. And they're done to lead the opposition. All right, where should we go from here? They were very instrumental. So as I was saying before, that it started with the literary figures, right? He brought this consortium of 25 literary figures to sway public opinion in favor of war. And then we have radio comes on the scene. And so in 1935, it was Harvard psychologist Gordon Alpert co-authored The Psychology of Radio with Hadley Cantrell. So Cantrell was roommates at Dartmouth with Rockefeller. And the Rockefellers founded this Office of Radio Research at Princeton University to study the influence of radio on different groups of listeners. The Rockefellers were very instrumental in all of Tavistock. So Tavistock's initial funding came from, you know, like the Milners, Roundtable groups, and Lord Rothermere, Radcliffe, and I'm trying to think, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Crown, of course. And then it goes through different stages where they get more funding. And of course, later, the Rockefellers were very instrumental in the official grant that launched what became the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. And that was in 1947. But before that, we have this, you know, radio research fund, and the NBC was very involved in this. And they did the, you know, of course, people will remember War of the Worlds. And Cantrell actually did a whole study on the effects of War of the Worlds, and Rockefeller wouldn't let him publish it. So it didn't come out for years. It was like 3 years later, he put a halt on the release of the results of this research that was done. But they were very involved in, you know, the psychology of radio and how they could manufacture public opinion using radio. And then that later parlayed into television. They were doing the same thing with television. I'm trying to think where we should go next, because we could go on for several hours. Let's see.
Monica told me that we had you for an hour. We can go for a little bit longer if you want, or we can wrap up here. And
up to you guys. I have
that seems like a natural breaking point, because that's where the modern Tavistock Institute comes out, starts. Yeah. And you and I are actually slated next week to do like another marathon session on like bringing it up to today. So maybe if Adam wants, like after we do that,
then we'll follow
you'll
up
be in a better position to summarize the like bring it up to today point if you wanted to do a part two. I don't know if they have
that would be awesome.
Yeah, I'm down. Yeah. Sorry. I feel like I threw out a lot and I don't know how much.
No, I can't believe you even got that far in an hour.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, I was trying to move it along because you can get stuck in. So, I mean, we didn't even cover like Toynbee and yeah, there are just so many figures, but yeah,
But that's how you prove it. Like, that's why it would have been way, I think Deborah would have, like, she justifiably asked questions. She doesn't let you just like keep rolling because she wants to actually follow. But in my opinion, that all the detail and the evidence that you bring, it makes it really irrefutable that all these dots are connected. There's a progression, there's a goal, they're reaching towards that goal. But if you just gloss over those details, then you're just another like conspiracy theorist or whatever.
Theorists without any
right,
you know, data points to like, substantiate the theory.
Yeah, you're a conspiracy historian.
Yes. Yeah. Cryptid. I'm trying to uncrypt history. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guys, let Courtney, you go first. Plug everything you got.
Okay. Well, the best place to find me would be at CourtneyTurner.com. I always say my name phonetically so those can find me because I spell it a little differently. It's Courtenay, so CourtenAy, and that's CourtenAy, like Courtenay Turner, TURNER.com. And that's the best place to find me. I'm pretty much on all platforms. I have a very small, like inconsistent presence on YouTube under the TPCT Truth Sleuths, but yeah, they kind of regularly take me down. Although I'm very close to 1,000 on there, so if anybody wants to help me get over the hump on that, that would be awesome. And we are gearing up to do we're doing a fundraiser actually this weekend for CauseFest. So I have a link. You could just go directly to the site. It's Rebels plural four spelled out FOR. cause.com. Cause stands for Creative Artists Uniting for the Sovereignty of Everyone, and we're doing a fundraiser in Vero Beach in conjunction with Stu Peters Fall Fest. But it looks like we're actually planning something possibly for the Friday night before as well. We have some pretty awesome entertaining acts that have agreed, so we're in the process of just, you know, making that happen. And so if anybody's interested in helping us to fund the next Cause Fest, because it is incredibly expensive and we greatly appreciate that, we're probably going to do it in March. I think we're thinking sometime in the next year, you know, like in the spring, and we're gearing up for that. And other than that, yeah, go to my website if you want to support my work, watch my podcast and all that fun stuff.
Awesome. Monica, go.
Yes. So you can find any kind of free videos, whatever. I have a YouTube channel. I put everything on rockfin.com/deepdives. You can listen to all of my content at Deep Dives with Monica Perez on your favorite podcasting platform. And if you want to hear some things and not others, you can go to monicasdeepdives.com and go to the listen tab. And then you can find interviews I've done, but you can also find the stuff that I do, firsthand research, where it's just me doing a little fire hose like Courtney, but they're only 45 minutes each. So you're not going to get like the 100-year treatment of anything. But if you are interested in some of the stuff I do, you can go to monicasdeepdives.com and just like search through there.
Awesome. Yeah. Go to her show. Our old show's up there right now. Yeah.
So, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Deep Dives has that my favorite appearance on Deborah Gets Red Pilled, where we talk about the Boston Marathon bombing. And Adam, if you let us put this stuff on our feeds, why don't you tell people where to find you in case that's where this ends up?
Okay. Yeah. Deborah Gets Red Pilled for podcasts, Twitter and Instagram too. So yeah, that's it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. I got to get going. I got a sick pig out in the barn. So.
Oh, no. I thought you might have a sick animal just because you're a little distracted there for just a second. But don't worry. I had your back.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye, guys. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people, all those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass. Delay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order are idiots. Playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that 7-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.